Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Is there a doctor in the house? Yes, lucky for us, there is, every Monday at this time. This morning, emergency medicine physician and associate chief medical officer for Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital, Dr. Jeffrey Bomer, is here. Doctor, good morning. Let's talk first about a study of 20,000 adults over two decades looking at the risk of dementia from sedentary behavior. And this was a wide age group that they looked at, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Like you said, they looked at these folks over their sort of their middle ages into their older age, and they looked at really was a good, really well done study. It was a longitudinal, what they call a longitudinal cohort study. So, and they really were able to look at how much passive sedentary time these patients were, or these subjects were spending every day, how much active sedentary time. So, when you're sitting down doing something passive, watching TV, scrolling through your phone, versus sitting down and doing a crossword puzzle or doing Sudoku or something that was actually active, activating the mind, and then also looking at how much physical activity they found. And it was pretty not unexpected, but I think it was pretty telling that those folks that were actually doing something active with their brains while they were sitting, being very passive and sedentary, actually had a decreased dementia risk by 7% just with 1 hour of difference. So 1 hour more a day of sitting down and doing a puzzle actually reduced your dementia risk by 7%. And then if you combine that with some physical activity, it went up to 11%. So I think it kind of goes back to, it's important that, I think we've heard the saying that the sitting is the new smoking. And I think there's probably some truth to that. Physical activity is very important, but it's also just as important to be engaging your brain. If you can't be active and you are sedentary, it's really important for you to spend some time activating your brain. So doing something that gets you thinking, reading something new, learning, learning a language, doing something that's actually stimulating your brain, because what it's doing is that you're increasing the blood flow to that part of the brain. You're kind of building that sort of cognitive reserve, building those neural networks. And if you're just sitting there not learning anything, just scrolling through and being very passive, you're doing yourself a disservice. You're doing your brain a disservice for sure. So very interesting study.
So not all screen time is the same when it comes to what might not be great for brain health. That's the takeaway, isn't it?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's things you're going to, if you're scrolling through things and learning, you're reading news, you're learning a new subject. I think that's different from just sort of passively listening to people spout off about their opinions about things. I think that's I think that's my takeaway. If I'm learning something, if it's something that's actually making me think, making me actually, it's something that's challenging my brain, engaging me. If I'm even just sitting down having a conversation with somebody on the phone or FaceTime or whatever it is, and actually that engagement is what's really important to the brain. But just being there, just sitting there passively just scrolling through or watching a program on TV where there's no learning involved, I think that's what defines passive and being sedentary for your brain as well.
I'll have to challenge people more listening to this program. I'll do what
I can.
what do we know now about some drugs and vaccines that may lower your risk of dementia?
Yeah, I think it's important, first of all, that when we're talking about the subject, that we're not talking about people that are developing dementia. That's a different subject. But there may be some things that we can do, or some medicines that we're taking that may reduce that developing dementia down the road. And I think what's probably the biggest take-home message here, Bob, is that it's taking care of our health, taking care of our cardiovascular systems actually means that we're taking care of our brains too. But having said that, they have done some studies, and I think it's pretty well documented now that the shingles vaccine, particularly the newer one that we're using in the United States right now, has been identified as reducing the development of dementia by 15% to 20%. And that's been validated with international studies. So I think, the question is why. It probably reduces inflammation that develops if you do get shingles. Flu vaccine as well. There's been some studies that show up to 40% reduction of dementia for those that get the flu vaccine regularly. And it probably has a lot to do with people that are getting vaccines, or those are same people that are taking care of their health. They're being preventative. They're being proactive about their health. And Mm-hmm. The flu vaccine is interesting, Bob, because actually the higher dose, the higher dose vaccine actually showed that those folks actually had an even higher reduction in the development of dementia than those that got the regular dose. So there was probably some dose dependent there, so there probably is something to do with the vaccine. But same story with some of the medications that we take for blood pressure, for cholesterol, that those antihypertensives and the statins that folks will take for those conditions have been shown to reduce dementia risk by about 10 to 15% overall. So probably has a lot to do with just, you know, like I said, you know, being healthy for your entire body, right? You know, being proactive and mm-hmm. treating blood pressure, treating cholesterol means that you're probably also preserving your brain's function as well as your heart's function, your blood vessels' function as well. So I think that there's definitely something there, but I think the overall take home is that, you know, taking care of your overall health means that you're also taking care of your brain's health too, and you're going to reduce your risk of dementia by doing that.
Yep, good to hear. There's new research on weight loss drugs. They don't work for everyone, do they, Doc?
No. So, you know, there's about 10 to 15% of folks that just are what they call non-responders. And, you know, that's probably the case with lots of different and a lot of the intentions of medications. And not everybody's going to have that response. We all have different DNA. We all have different makeup. So we're not all going to respond to a drug the same way. So that's about 10 to 15% with these GLP-1s. But what they have found is that almost across the board that folks that aren't responding with the weight loss do have positive effects on their metabolism. So a lot of these folks are diabetics. They have what we call steatotic steatosis or fatty liver. And so they've actually seen that folks that are taking these meds and aren't necessarily having the weight loss that they were hoping to see are having less strokes, less heart attacks. They're developing heart failure less often. They're having people that do have the fatty liver are seeing improvements with that. So I think, you know, these drugs that have the intention of treating just diabetes and just weight loss probably have more effects on other conditions as well. And so we're probably going to have to relook at who should get approval for these medications, and it shouldn't just be the marker of how much weight did you lose. You know, I think a lot of these medicines are saying if you don't lose that 5%, if the intention was weight loss, if you don't lose that 5% over a given period of time, that the insurance won't cover it. Well, we may need to relook at that, and I think that I think that we're going to change those parameters as we learn more and more studies are done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the latest findings do point to health benefits beyond weight loss, don't they?
For sure, yeah. I mean, like I mentioned, it's you know, I think we're seeing positive effects on blood pressure, positive effects on obviously on insulin spikes, vascular tone. It looks like these things have an anti-inflammatory effect on or the way the liver's function. So that's why we're seeing that improvement in liver and that's hepatic steatosis. So there's something that's going on that's really improving the overall the metabolic signaling that's happening in the body that this drug has an impact on. So it's mm-hmm. it's not just weight loss, it's not just diabetes. It definitely is folks that have this sort of deranged metabolism or deranged metabolic effects from lifestyle, from genetics, whatever it might be. This drug is having a positive effect on that. So those folks that aren't having a positive response with their weight are probably having benefits otherwise. So just because they're carrying a couple extra pounds doesn't mean that they're not having a positive impact on their overall health.
Right. More now with Northwestern Medicine's Dr. Jeffrey Bohmer. What happens when we have more than the recommended fewer than 50 grams of sugar a day? We all do. A BBC health reporter gave up sugar for 6 weeks. Doctor is a sugar addict. I'm almost afraid to ask, but what did this reporter learn?
Well, he basically kind of confirmed what a lot of people suspect, that it sugar is addictive. I mean, it does hit those same reward centers in our brain that are sort of dependent on dopamine, and it's not quite as addictive as some of the some of these substances like opioids and other addictive substances, but it does have that. I mean, when you eat sugar, eat something very sweet, it does kick in that reward system, and you want more of it. You have these escalated cravings, and you know that's why sometimes it's hard to have just one cookie, right? So, but the problem with that is when you're having these high sugar desserts and treats, is that it it causes these rapid spikes in glucose, which is followed by a rapid surge of insulin, which causes your glucose to drop. And then that's when the fatigue sets in. You start to feel hungry because your sugar drops, even though you don't need the calories, and you start getting these cravings, and it creates this vicious cycle. So so the problem with that is over time, that's where you have these real negative effects on your body, right? So you have increased, like I mentioned previously about hepatic steatosis, that's that liver fat. It causes increase in fat deposits in your liver. Your insulin resistance goes up, so that starts to bring in diabetes over time. Your triglycerides go up, causes increased inflammation in your body. So it's the sugars, whether they be in cookies or in soda, whatever it is, that it is very bad and it is addictive. So, and what he found when he went through this sort of 6-week trial of cutting sugars out, that first week was probably the toughest for him. He talked about he had like sort of these withdrawal like symptoms. He was irritable. He was having these cravings, but over a couple of weeks after that, things seemed to reset. And he noted that when he would eat fruit, that the fruit tasted a lot sweeter. So it sort of his taste buds reset, and the cravings dropped significantly. And as he got into the latter half of his 6-week trial, he started to feel like he had more energy, despite not having these, taking in lots of sugar. He actually felt like he had more energy. He was snacking less, and then he was keeping track of his metabolic markers and his blood work, and those improved as well. So the hardest part really seems like that first week, if you're going to cut out sugar, which is not a bad thing, which is probably something we all should consider. And after that, your body starts working with you, not against you, I would say. But I think the take home here, Bob, is that, I don't think we have to give up sugar altogether, these added sugars or treats altogether. It's everything's in moderation. So maybe during the week, no sugars, and give yourself a treat on the weekend. Seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do.
We'll get this conversation posted at WGNRadio.com, and I think every time I am craving sugar, I'll just have to listen to you talking about this. Boy, one of the big problems, though, hidden sugar, it's everywhere, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think, a lot of the way food is processed these days is that it's easier just to put, it's more palatable if there's sugar in it. So, bread is a common one, right? So we don't think about necessarily, you think you're eating a wheat bread sandwich and you think it's healthy, but the reality of it is it's loaded with carbohydrate, loaded with sugars, these added sugars. And so it's hard to avoid. So you have to just be very, very intentional about what you're eating and really kind of focus on whole foods. For instance, when I'm eating bread, I try to eat sourdough bread, less ingredients. It's less of that carbohydrate or less of that sugar rush. And then make sure that you're having fiber when you're eating your sugar. So I think, that's one of the great things about eating fruit is that typically, the fruit is also got fiber with it, so it decreases the processing time of your body. So you're not going to get that glucose rush that you're going to get when you're just eating, say, a piece of cake or that big slice of white bread at a restaurant. You're not going to get those big rushes.
Get the apples and grapes in here for me, please. Thanks, Dr. Jeffrey Boomer, Northwestern Medicine. Talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.